Hello, and welcome to the Expanding Eyes podcast. We have been talking for some weeks about Shakespeare's last great play, The Tempest, and we're almost finished with that discussion. We have arrived almost at the fifth and final act, and therefore it's time for me to start thinking about what work we should go on to next. And I've decided, if you have been curious, to take a break from Shakespeare temporarily, not permanently. There are many great plays by Shakespeare that we have not touched yet, and I do not plan to break permanently from Shakespeare, probably ever in the duration of this podcast. However, a little variation I thought might be a good idea, lest it go on for years and years and years, all with one author. There are other works, and I thought that the next work that we might take a look at is a work that in fact bears an intensely close relationship to Shakespeare. And it also helps, to be honest, that I happen to be teaching it right now in my honors class, and therefore I'm kind of up on it. And that is Goethe's Faust, the most famous single work of German literature by the most famous single author in German literature, on the highest possible genius level of reputation that Shakespeare holds in English-speaking culture. Goethe holds that in German literature. And Faust is, of course, his greatest work. And it is a work intensely influenced by Shakespeare. It's cast in a dramatic form, though it is certainly anything but a conventional drama. But that's the least of it. The themes, and to some degree the style, of at least three Shakespeare plays intensely influenced Goethe's Faust. And we have taken a look in this podcast at all three of them. Hamlet, of course, because, well, everybody in the Romantic era was influenced by Hamlet, but also A Midsummer Night's Dream, and finally, The Tempest itself. There are explicit allusions to all three of these plays pervasively, not just glancingly, but pervasively in Faust. And therefore, a worthy successor to our discussion here of Shakespeare right at this point. So we will begin Faust next week and give a little bit of background, since people may not be as familiar with Goethe or Faust as they are with Shakespeare. But first we have to return to The Tempest, where we have almost but not quite arrived at Act 5, the final act and the resolution. We left off last time in Act 4 with the wedding mask summoned up by Prospero's magical powers of illusion, summoned up a whole pageant and spectacle as a wedding present, or at least an engagement gift, for the bride and groom to be, his daughter Miranda, who is going to marry Prince Ferdinand, the son of Alonso. Ferdinand came through his ordeals put upon him by Prospero with flying colors, and now Prospero is turning into a benevolent parent, blessing this couple and giving them this gift of a vision. And we talked about it last time, but to quickly remind for thematic purposes, it is a vision in terms of classical mythology, though Christian parallels would be set to resonating in the audience's mind beyond a doubt. But Shakespeare keeps it in a classical tonality, and it is a vision of the vertical axis mundi, or chain of being. That is partly because of the form of this drama. It is another, yet another, Shakespearean play within a play. And this one takes the form of a particular type of play called a masque, MASQUE in the normal spelling, a courtly genre of drama as opposed to the popular drama of the Globe Theater. And the masque was part spectacle and entertainment, but partly also court propaganda, because the chain of being that it was dramatizing is, of course, the ideology that gives the ruling class its power. And that's one thing. And of course, the Tempest was being put on because Shakespeare's men were the king's men. They had a very close relationship with the court by this late period of time. And we know that the Tempest was put on twice in front of royalty, once in 1611, and then again in 1613 for an actual wedding, the wedding of King James's daughter. This is a wedding masque, and therefore more than just a political statement. And what is it a statement of? But it's a vision of a paradisal, ideal vision. It is the same vision as Gonzalo's much briefer vision of, if I ruled this island, I would bring back the golden age. And it is indeed a vision of the golden age, but this time expanded and extending all the way up to the heavenly powers, symbolized by Juno, who descends by stage machinery in a car, as it said, a vehicle, down to the level of the paradisal earth, where there is the goddess Ceres, from which we get our word cereal, goddess of natural fertility. And in this version, she is also identical with Demeter and refers to her daughter Persephone, who was carried off into the underworld, so that we get the whole extent of the axis, at least by allusion. And the wedding couple are utterly enchanted by this. They are enspelled by it. And Ferdinand says, this is a most majestic vision and harmonious charmingly. Let me live here forever. So rare a wondered father and a wife makes this place paradise. Prospero has made this island of castaways seem like a paradise, so much that Ferdinand would like to live here in that paradise. And that's a good gift to give young people as they go out into the world. And yet, Prospero risks spoiling it. Immediately after that, he suddenly starts and realizes that he has forgotten the plots that are working out there. I had forgot that foul conspiracy of the beast Caliban and his confederates against my life. The minute of their plot has almost come. Suddenly, I have to remember everything, and something dropped out of my mind. If you wonder why Prospero's a rather irritable fellow, it's partly his job. He's partly a man of responsibilities, and it makes him a bit grumpy sometimes. But there's more to this, because Prospero goes on. The wedding mass suddenly disappears. It's over anyway, but suddenly it vanishes. And Prospero gives his famous speech that begins, "Our revels now are ended," and says, "These, our actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits, and are melted into air, into thin air." And, like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit, shall dissolve, and, like this insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. It's melted away. It was an illusion. And we all knew it was an illusion. It's a theatrical spectacle. And that's what theater is. It's summoned up illusions. And we know, even as we are watching it and suspending our disbelief, in Coleridge's phrase, we still know in the back of our minds that we are watching an illusion, even if it's one that we are very taken up in. Because otherwise, we would be naive like the rude mechanicals in Midsummer Night's Dream, who take everything literally and are afraid that when they bring a guy in a lion costume on stage in their production, that the ladies are all going to faint because they'll think it's a real lion. We know it's not a real lion. But then Prospero turns that dissolving spirit upon our life itself. Yea, the great globe itself, which any annotated edition will probably tell you is an oblique reference to the globe theater, but it means the globe. It means life and all life upon the globe, stuff such as dreams are made on. Well, that's really not in the celebratory wedding spirit there, and Prospero does rather apologize. Sir, I am vexed. Bear with my weakness. My old brain is troubled. A turn or two I'll walk to still my beating mind. He's quite upset. And we are too, perhaps, because we were given this hopeful vision of a paradise that was intended to bless a marriage, and a marriage is something that goes on into the future, and you want hopefulness for that future. And Prospero celebrates the wedding of his daughter by saying everything is going to vanish where such things as dreams are made on. It's a troubling moment. And that is one of the two thematic axes, so to speak, that we have to resolve by the end of our discussion of The Tempest. This one has to do with the nature of reality and illusion. What is the point of an ideal vision if it's just illusion and then we're back to the real world again? But we're told that the real world is also an illusion. So then what? Is there anything hopeful here? Why would Prospero, let alone Shakespeare, be simply undercutting and subverting in what seems like a very cruel way? Is there nothing hopeful to go on to a next step in this argument? And that is where we have to go. We think of art, the function of art, as the summoning up of illusions, yes. And they are fictions. We know that they are not real. And there are some people who don't have much patience with the arts, or who at most see them as just escapist entertainment, because, hey, it's not real, it's all fiction. I'm a real-world guy. I really, except for a momentary escape, I don't really have much time in my life for something that's just illusion. I'd rather learn about reality. But art is talking about reality. And in fact, what it is saying here as elsewhere is that what we take as the so-called real world is an illusion that you might say we've gotten very used to the degree that it is habitual and we're rather stuck in it. But it is an illusion, and you don't have to be an intellectual to understand that. All you have to do is get older, as Prospero has just referred to himself as old. And Shakespeare was. By the standards of the time, he was in his late 40s, pushing 50, but that was old age at that point. And sure enough, he did not live more than a few years after writing The Tempest. He is close to the end, and so is Prospero, who says later that he is going to go back to Milan, where every third thought shall be of his grave, another nice, cheerful little thing to toss off to people. But old age doesn't have to be melancholy, but old age is aware that the world behind it, so to speak, in the past, had to be in some manner an illusion because it has dissolved and left not a wreck behind, or so it feels sometimes. That's the thing. It can't be entirely real if it vanishes. Even having lived as long as I have and been through several generations of students, I'm constantly aware of things that happened when I was their age, that it would be decades upon decades. They were unborn yet for decades. There's something illusory about the so-called real world. And you don't, as I say, have to be an intellectual to come to feel that. Art deals in illusion, that knows it's illusion. But art has two functions. As the real world dissolves into illusion, art summons up illusions that have something to do with the real, but a reality that is different, of a different type from ordinary reality, from that which vanishes. There is an echo in The Tempest, seemingly, of something like the book of Ecclesiastes in the Bible, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And Northrop Frye, in his book on the Bible, The Great Code, points out that the word translated in the King James Version as vanity in that famous passage, in the original means something like fog or mist. But fog or mist hides, and when it is dispelled, something else might appear. The vision, the wedding pageant that Ferdinand and Miranda have just seen is an ideal vision of an earthly paradise, not a heavenly spiritual realm, but an earthly paradise, here and now, but the here and now transformed into what, in fact, it could be. And that is one use of art. Or rather, it is two, the one being the other side of the other. Art is decreative, to use a term I started using a long time ago, for the purpose of saying that the imagination has a decreative power of dissolving the illusions that we habitually think are real, simply because of the passive mental state that we are in when we receive them. Art decreates, and therefore it's like a magician that makes things vanish. But art does something in the other direction. It recreates as well as decreates. And it creates visions that are models, as the paradisal vision of the wedding pageant is a model. It is a model of what life could be, of possibility and therefore of hope, and therefore appropriate as a wedding gift for two young people. And it could be. It's not real now, no, but it could be. It is a model of what could be brought into being. And that is the third use of art, to decreate illusion, to give a model of a greater reality, and third, to begin bringing about that reality through changing people. Art works on people and, at its best, changes them. My phrase, expanding eyes, points to exactly that as the greatest function of the human imagination. And that's what Prospero has been doing. And that takes us from this theme of what is reality and the use of illusion, because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about what good are illusions. Art is just illusions. What good are they? They do a lot of things, as I've just said. Illusions work on people. Illusions can change people, and then people can change the world. This is entirely what everything that I have ever had to say, not to sound too preachy about it, has ever been about. This is the power that resides in us, that we have been given, that somehow seems to be a way of remaking the world, not out of our own will to power. It's very dangerous to begin thinking in that way, but something that may act through us, blow through us, like the wind that blows through so much romantic poetry. Shelley's Ode to the West Wind, Coleridge's Aeolian Harp, something that blows through us, blows through the world. And of course, wind is a metaphor for the spirit in the Bible and elsewhere. And if we allow the wind to blow through us, it may change things. That is the task. And we have to be the instrument. And that is an active thing to do. And Prospero is doing it. He learned his lesson the hard way 12 years ago in Milan. He abdicated his responsibilities, refused to pay attention to his responsibilities as a ruler, and got himself deposed in the process. Now he is determined to make up for that and use his power to remake the community that he came out of, and that he does have responsibility. He is still the rightful duke, and therefore he does have a rightful authority here to put the people, as we have seen, of the party that came from the ship through various ordeals appropriate to their situation and their quality of their minds, for the purpose of, first of all, out of justice, punishing and rehabilitating them. Some of them don't need that, like Gonzalo, but most of them do. Stefano and Trinculo, Antonio and Sebastian, even Alonso, who went along with the plot to depose Prospero years ago, apparently out of buying in to a kind of a lust for power and has been feeling guilty about it ever since, and so forth. And Prospero has been putting these people through various ordeals that, one, punish, two, change and rehabilitate them, and three, will, we hope, draw them once again together into a more genuine community than they were before. And he has a right to do this with everybody except the natives of the island, Ariel and Caliban. And that is the most troubling thing about Prospero. Students, when I teach The Tempest, I'm used to it by now, they never much like Prospero, and I can certainly see why. He's moody, he's snappish, and he's not nearly as likable as Gonzalo. The contrast is very great. And what is the difference? I always try to make a case. I don't seem to succeed. But I always try to make a case for Prospero that the difference is that Prospero feels the strain of responsibility. He actually has to use power to change things, to rule things, to bring things about. And that involves breaking a few eggs to make the omelet. Gonzalo does not have that responsibility. He is a genuinely good man, but he can be a little more relaxed and genial. He does not have the irritability that responsibility brings with it. Like, I might add, glancingly, both captains of the Enterprise in Star Trek. They're a little bit testy every so often because it comes with the job. And that's Prospero, and he puts people through ordeals. And you can say, by what right does he play God? But he does have authority, and he has to exercise it. And people who do that at times have to be coercive, and that includes teachers. Teachers, coaches, anybody who has to be in a position of authority over other people to bring something good about. They're not going to always win the popularity contest because of having to put people through ordeals, and people don't like that. So this is the responsibility that Prospero has, and he's fulfilling it to the best of his ability, and he also, quite admirably, is wary of falling into a power trip, which is why he immediately claims that the minute he completes this task, he will renounce his magic, break his staff, and drown his books. This abdication in a good sense of power, abdicating it when the task has been done, rather than clinging to it and therefore becoming intoxicated with it. This is the theme of The Lord of the Rings ahead of time, you might say. And Prospero gives up his magic as, among the great fantasy series, itself influenced by Tolkien, Ursula Le Guin's Earthsea Saga, the great magician Ged expends all his magic to save the realm of Earthsea, and goes back to where he came from and becomes the goat herder that he started out with as a boy. Power corrupts, and Prospero knows that. And that is the problem with Antonio and Sebastian and Stefano and Trinculo on different levels. They are power-crazed and power-hungry. Part of the power here is political power. And The Tempest has been processed extensively over the last 40 years or so in an era of post-imperialist, post-colonialist literary criticism. And it becomes rather controversial because Prospero does not have a proper authority over Ariel and Caliban, but exercises it anyway, and makes himself look like the kind of European imperialist that would become all too familiar in the two centuries coming after The Tempest. Shakespeare is amazingly prophetic in this play. The bad people in the play, or at least the flawed people in the play. Are imperialists very much in the mode of European imperialism to come? Antonio and Sebastian are on a pure power trip. They're determined to be king over this land, even though it's a desert island in the middle of nowhere. It's just pure power lust. Stefano and Trinculo are driven by greed and want to exploit the natives. And again, things that would become all too familiar in the age of empires just around the corner. And the treatment of the indigenous people, a very sore spot, here represented by Ariel and Caliban. Prospero, we have to be fair and say that Prospero does not have the same desires as an ordinary imperialist. He is not crazed by the lust to rule or the lust to exploit. And he represents, I would say, the idealistic aspect of the imperialist era, the white savior, as we now call it, aspect. He really does want to make the world a better place. And it is within his desires to help the natives by his own light. As they say, we now call it white savior mentality. With Ariel, it's a more positive thing. There's a transactional relationship, for one thing, with Prospero and Ariel. Prospero did Ariel a huge favor, rescued him when Ariel was pent up in a tree for years by the witch Sycorax. So Ariel does owe Prospero something pretty big and is aware of it. And at the same time, the two respect each other and quite explicitly love each other. They say so. Yes, it's still within a colonialist framework, perhaps, but it's still moving within that framework. It's a genuine regard for each other. The tough one is Caliban, where Prospero simply has a blind spot, and Shakespeare knows it. Prospero's witheringly negative opinions about Caliban are not those of Shakespeare. That is clear. We just see that from the play. It's wrong to say so. So we have to assume that what Shakespeare is doing is actually implicitly criticizing Prospero, who does a creditable job elsewhere, but with Caliban simply has a strange blind spot. He sees no good in Caliban, and we know that's not true. Caliban is a portrayal of indigenous people according to the smug prejudices of Europeans of Shakespeare's time, that they were savages, they were superstitious, they were childlike, and so forth and so on. But we also remember that Shakespeare was influenced by Montaigne's essay on cannibals, whose theme is that native peoples, once you get past not liking their diet very much, have virtues that Europeans often lack. And that is most certainly true within The Tempest. Caliban is a more admirable character than Antonio, Sebastian, Stefano, and Trinculo, more than all of them rolled up together. He is not a bad person, and he is capable of learning and has already learned by his own description. He will never be so gullible about these people ever again and never be conned ever again. And who knows what he might go on to. Shakespeare is aware of that. Prospero, strangely, is not. I can only say, rather tentatively, that Prospero, insofar as he is a colonialist, is driven by the idealism about improving for people's own good, the white savior thing. And he's very irritated that the natives to be improved are not cooperating with his plan. And that's a blind spot. It is an imperfection, and Shakespeare seems determined to show Prospero as imperfect, very much as he was determined to show the Duke as imperfect in Measure for Measure. The two are very much parallel characters. Therefore, Prospero is imperfect, but he does renounce his power, and he begs forgiveness in the final speech of the play, as he begs the audience for forgiveness in a passage that, as Northrop Frye says, echoes the Lord's Prayer, "Forgive us our trespasses," the theme of forgiveness that is so pervasive in late Shakespeare. And what has Prospero done? He's done a lot of good among these people. He has not done it perhaps perfectly, but he has done it. And if we pass a judgment upon him, perhaps we should grant the forgiveness that he begs, if only because of the Lord's Prayer, "Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Judge not that ye be not judged." And the world has been transformed. It's not an earthly paradise. Miranda miraculously sees all sorts of new things and new people and bursts out with the famous phrase, "Oh, brave new world that has such people in it." And her father says, "Thou art young yet. You've got a lot to learn." "Yeah, these people, well, let me tell you, one's my brother and he tried to murder me," etc. And he's right, the voice of experience is correct, and after a fashion, the voice of Miranda is a voice of naivete, but not entirely, because not only have people been changed for the better, but things miraculously have happened here. Things that happen, as they say, only in a play, have happened, and have happened within 3 hours. There's a constant reference to only 3 hours have passed. Alonso looks at his son, who now has a bride-to-be, and says, "Boy, you work fast. Even Romeo and Juliet didn't do it that quickly." But it has been transformed in a blink of time, even though it built up to it for 12 years of ordeal. Nonetheless, people have come back to life, and Ferdinand bursts out, "Though the seas threaten, they are merciful. I have cursed them without cause." He thought his father was dead, and his father has returned. And two people have found true love. Alonso has been redeemed out of his guilt, and all are united again. The mad dogs, Antonio and Sebastian, at least have been kenneled and defanged, perhaps for the time being. There are some people you cannot change and reform, but you can curb their power. Miraculous things have happened. It is possible to change and change things miraculously. And that is why two words echo throughout this fifth act. The one is the word wonder. This is wonder. And the other is strange. The word strange occurs at the end of the play 6 times on the next to the last page. Strange and wonderful. Wonderful and strange. That is the tempest, but that is life too. And we should not forget that. on to Goethe's Faust next week.